Good. So let us then turn immediately to our next talk, and then we will take all of the questions together, and then turn finally to the theoretical reflection at the very end. So it is now a tremendous honor to introduce Vincian Perrin-Delforge and John Scheid. So I assume, Vincian, you'll be mainly presenting, but John, you will be here as well. So we will.
No, it's not John.
Oh, you're not John.
No, John, it's in absentia.
Ah, so John is in absentia.
Yes,
so
he's unable to be here at this moment. So he apologizes a lot.
Not at all.
No.
So, then, please, join me in giving our very warmest welcome to Vincian Perrin-Delforge.
Oh, thank you, Michael. A scholarly meeting like the present one is a sort of ritual. And the first obligation in this context is to thank the organizers for their invitation. And it's with great pleasure that I meet this ritual requirement and warmly thank An Cheng and Stéphane Feuillas for extending the scope of their investigation of Chinese rituals to the far west of Greece and Rome. The use of the word ritual to refer to the initial words of thanks in a conference makes it clear that a ritual does not necessarily belong to religion. In the modern sense of, and I quote a definition by Spiro in 1966, an institution consisting of culturally patterned interaction with culturally postulated superhuman beings, end of quote. Nevertheless, this is the sense we give to the term ritual in our joint paper, which addresses some questions related to ritual and writing in the Greek and Roman religions. The initial premise of the discussion is a self-evident statement. Neither Greek nor Roman religion can be considered as a religion of the book in the common sense of a system based on a sacred scripture encapsulating a revelation and giving birth to dogmas. But this premise must be immediately qualified because writing related to religion was not absent in these cultures, where orality coexisted with writing during centuries. Sanctuaries were full of inscriptions and graffiti, while written ritual norms are attested in Greece and priestly books in Rome. Cleo Carastro has just analyzed the writing down of oracular questions or answers, and so we do not address this specific topic. We will respectively, even if I'm alone to speak, we will respectively focus on the ritual prescriptions preserved on stone in Greek sanctuaries and on the so-called books of the priest in Rome. The shared background of both parts of our lecture is the question of religious authority and codification with regard to ritual performance. So John Scheid, with my voice, will refer to Roman priestly books in a moment. But as far as ancient Greece is concerned, no book of this type is attested, and so such writings do not seem to have ever been the rule. Some books are mentioned in connection with the so-called Orphic rituals, but the issue is much discussed and badly evidenced. The religion of the Greeks was not a religion of the book. Nevertheless, with the adoption of alphabetic writing in early archaic times in the 8th century BC, the Greek city-states progressively used this tool for fixing their decisions and publicly displaying them when necessary. Among the wide range of measures adopted by the cities, one finds decisions related to the gods, sanctuaries, rituals undertaken for the well-being of the community. Unfortunately, official Greek archives are almost completely lost, but we know that some of them contain a section devoted to regulations concerning sacred issues. What is now left of the measures taken in the area of religion is a very small part of the decisions once written down, those inscribed on durable materials such as stone, more rarely metal, and found by chance in excavations. In addition, inscribed ritual norms were never considered as practical guides for concrete cult performance. Had we access to all the Greek civic archives related to rituals, we would still not grasp most details of ritual processes. And I will return to this point a bit later. Does this mean that practical guides for rituals did not exist in ancient Greece? Absolute certainty is impossible, but no evidence of this kind has been preserved in our evidence. We do know that treatises about rituals were composed during the Hellenistic period. Some titles and the names of authors are known, but not a single work of this kind has survived. Only scattered pieces are available, which were gathered by Alois Tresp in 1914 in a book significantly entitled Die Fragmente der griechischen Kultschriftsteller. Reading these fragments, we can observe that the treatises to which they originally belonged were the products of learned inquiries rooted in scholarly erudition. They were not prescriptive, and so probably not practical guides to be used for a proper performance of rituals. They were descriptive and expository. What were their sources of information? We do not know. A Quellenforschung is impossible to carry out, since almost everything is lost. We can always dream of a manuscript or papyrus still to be uncovered, which would provide such an exegeticon, but this hope is unreasonable and probably unwise. Accordingly, epigraphic prescriptions related to rituals give us a rare opportunity to collect pieces of information which would otherwise have completely vanished. However, epigraphic documents referring to rituals can have many different objectives, depending on the kind of text we have to deal with. The material gathered in the study of Greek ritual norms is embedded in documents as varied as civic decrees regarding cult, sacrificial calendars, sales of priesthoods, familial foundation, funerary laws, oracles, or even boundary stones and dedications. The authorities issuing these documents can be cities and their subgroups, families, associations, or even individuals, for example, in some cases where a brief cult regulation is connected to the dedication of an altar. And I present you the website of a project that I have been conducting for many years, and the name of this project is Collection of Greek Ritual Norms. And at the address put on the screen, you can find this collection completely in open access. Accordingly, we must be conscious that our knowledge of Greek rituals as they were effectively performed by local communities is partial and severely limited. And this statement is valid for Rome too. That being said, I return to the question which I raised earlier. What kind of information is available in epigraphic ritual norms, and why was it written down? Due consideration must be given to the oral and unwritten character of Greek ritual tradition, as Cleo was referring in some moment. What is recorded in the epigraphic evidence is what is exceptional, or at least noteworthy and worth writing down, even if we are often unable to reconstruct the background of such a need. When the evidence gives us some keys to understanding what happened, we can identify political transformations impacting the religious life of groups, or financial pressures necessitating the cost sharing of the sacrifices. And about political transformation, I show you the example of the island of Kos, which issued a civic decree in the 4th century BC, containing the codification of various rules of purity for priests and priestesses. And the text itself states that, I quote, that it's inscribed so that the purifications and cleansings are performed according to the sacred and ancestral customs or tradition. And you can see, if you read the Greek, that it's the term nomos to which Cleo referred. These sacred norms to which the text refers were previously recorded in archives, but we do not know exactly why the inhabitant of Kos felt the necessity to publicize them on several stelae erected in conspicuous places of worship. The extant stelae recording such purity rules is heavily damaged, but what is readable shows that the rules it contained were more precise than many other documents referring to rituals. Perhaps because purity became a sensitive issue on the island at some point during the Hellenistic period, but we can only propose hypotheses. Purity rituals are well attested in our evidence, but the main ritual performed by Greek communities for over a millennium was undoubtedly animal sacrifice. As far as thusia, the Greek name for sacrifice, is concerned, Greek ritual norms clearly confirm that a range of actions to be performed were not made explicit because, at a fundamental level, this kind of sacrifice involved a basic series of actions that were part of common knowledge and did not need to be spelled out. The possibility for private individuals to offer sacrifices in sanctuaries without need of a ritual expert or a priest is a strong confirmation of this basic level of knowledge. When new configuration emerged in a group, then the necessity of specifying at some level of detail what had to be done in ritual context arose. For example, gathering several settlements in one city required that the religious life of the new city be organized in such a way as to provide the same degree of information and knowledge to all its inhabitants. However, the basic elements presumed to be known by all the members of the previous communities were left implicit. An interesting question, as far as Greek ritual norms are concerned, is the scale of the common knowledge presupposed by these documents. Can we identify local, regional, or even Panhellenic levels of shared knowledge? In other words, are we in a position to recognize something typically Greek in the sacrificial ritual performed by Greek groups beyond the ritual specificities of these particular groups on a local or a regional level? And I resort to a linguistic metaphor to make my question even clearer. Does a common Hellenic sacrificial language exist in parallel with its multiple dialectal expressions? An inscription newly discovered in ancient Thessaly in central Greece gives us a beautiful opportunity to address the question. The text, and you see the stele, the two faces of the stele on the screen, the text dated to the 3rd or 2nd century BC belongs to the category of the epigraphic ritual norms. Insofar as it prescribes a range of sacrifices to be offered to various gods. The authority issuing the document, if any was mentioned, is now lost in the damaged parts of the stele. But the vast majority of the prescribed sacrifices and some of the gods mentioned are so exotic on a Greek point of view that we can reasonably attribute that regulation to an association mixing together Syrian or other Near Eastern people and Greek members. And this inscription has already provided a lot of studies. For the first time, and that's my point, because the text is very long, for the first time in the epigraphic evidence written in Greek, we find the expression to sacrifice according to the Greek norm. And here is the part of the text that I want to analyze with you. So the expression tu ein teteo helleniko nomo, that I translate to sacrifice according to the Greek norm or tradition or custom or right. It can be translated like that. So depending on the translation chosen for Hellenikos nomos. The expression is unique in epigraphy and exceptional in other textual evidence. The procedure is described in detail. I don't read the translation, but I paraphrase. Any sacrificial animal can be offered except a pig, an exception which is actually not Greek. Some cakes are to be deposited on the table, as well as olive oil for a lamb, wine, the boiled breast and one raw leg of the animal. Some of the innards are cooked for the priestess, liver, lungs, diaphragm, left kidney and tongue, while the right kidney, right extremities, acrocolon, it's difficult to translate, the heart, omentum, the front leg and a part of the tail must go into the fire on the altar. The same ritual process is to be followed when sacrificing sheep and bovines. In other inscriptions, including elements related to sacrifice, issued by Greek and only Greek groups, such as cities, families, association. So in these other inscriptions, one of the main objectives of writing down prescription is to guarantee that each participant in the ritual, whether a divine recipient or human agent, will receive his or her due. In the case of the hybrid Thessalian group, the same preoccupation probably underlies the regulation, but we also have to take into account the necessity of informing people who do not share the same level of ritual knowledge. A final question must be addressed before passing the torch to John Scheid, if it will be me, and traveling to Rome. What is specifically Greek in the Greek way of sacrificing prescribed in the text? Some interpreters consider that it refers to sacrifices of sheep, bovines, and larger animals in general, in contrast with the sacrifice of birds and goats, more common in the various Near Eastern offerings documented in the text. This is perhaps partly the case. But a close comparison between all the sacrifices mentioned on the stele, and you have to trust me, of course, I cannot display the whole material. A close comparison between all the sacrifices mentioned on the stele shows that the major difference in this case is the cutting of portions from the animal carcass and the deposition of some of them for the gods into the fire burning on the altar. All the other sacrifices mentioned on the stele imply either the deposition of portions on the table but without burning, or complete burning of the animal called the Holocaust. The Greek way of sacrificing in this text is a middle ground between these two types of sacrifice. Of course, we know that Holocaustic sacrifices were also performed in Greek cult, but they were very, very rare. And in the present text, they are not considered as a Greek way of performing a sacrificial ritual. In any case, the necessity to label this ritual as typically Greek emerged from the mixed composition of the association, which probably lies behind the regulation. We would be in a better position to assess the situation if we had other sacrificial regulations issued by the city in whose territory the sanctuary of the association was built. Unfortunately, this is not the case, and the comparison can only be made with sacrificial rules issued in other regions of the Greek world. The outstanding character of the Thessalian document lies in the level of detail achieved by the description of the divine part burnt onto the altar. This is really exceptional. Nowhere else in our evidence do we attain such a degree of precision, probably because the composition of the divine part to be given to a deity in its sanctuary normally, but not in this case, normally belongs to the shared knowledge of the community offering sacrifices. A Liber Sacerdotum, a priestly book, would have been a wonderful tool for those who try to understand the sacrifices offered in the various Greek cities. But as I said earlier, this kind of book probably never existed in the Greek world. But Rome is not Greece. even if at some point Greece became part of Rome. And so now you have to imagine that I'm John Chang. Probably it will be a bit difficult. But so I, John Chang, I don't want to question the problem of the existence of the books of the Roman priest, but I rather want to have a look at what really existed. Current studies simply take up traditional positions, consider the problem globally, or eventually explain the evolution of a single type of writing, for example, the so-called commentary of the priest. It's therefore not useless to face this question once again with the necessary caution. Priestly books are not the only written documents concerning religion, but as they were the center of the Roman religious and scholarly tradition, it seemed reasonable to focus on them during this conference in the context of a comparison with the Greek and with the Chinese world. The existence of these books, attested by many sources, is beyond doubt. Less assured, however, are the reconstructions that scholars make of them. What was a Roman sacerdotal book? Two opinions confront each other since the beginning of the 19th century at least, who consider the books of the priest, on the one hand, as normative books expressing, among others, the rule of worship, and on the other, as a set of reports of the activities and decisions of the priestly colleges. The search for ritual books, or ritual text in German, if possible very ancient books, was so important in the 19th century because these Hochbücher were supposed to have collected and fixed at the time when they started to petrify the spontaneous gesture of primitive religion, an obsession of the 19th century. But as scholars have eventually admitted, if there has been in all likelihood never, in any case in Rome, any kind of Urbücher or ritual text, what was a Roman sacerdotal book? The most logical and reliable way is to start from the evidence, including direct sources that have generally been excluded from the survey, collections like the priestly reports preserved by miracle, and you have the literature on the subject. These exceptional documents are commonly referred to as commentarii, reports, registers. Two sets of reports have survived, those of the secular games and those of the Fratres Arvales, the Arval brothers, which are preserved thanks to inscriptions on marble, like my own ritual norms. But these texts are only transcripts and should not be considered a priori as complete versions of the priestly commentarii. The case of the two comments of the secular games of 17 BC and 204 AD clearly shows this. The college of the so-called 15 men, the Quin Decemviri, was responsible for managing and executing the oracles delivered by the Sibylline books. This means that besides the consultation of the books, the preparation of the oracles and the eventual celebration of the prescribed ritual, this college was also in charge of supervising in the future the execution of the recommendations made by the oracle. As a result, the daily task of the Quin Decemvir far exceeded the celebration of the secular games, and it's evident that the document of 17 BC and from 204 AD are only excerpts from their commentary. This is also what their title explicitly says, at least in 204, since it speaks of the, I quote, commentarium on the seven secular games and not the commentarium of the Quin Decemviri. Nevertheless, it's undeniable that the extract itself is complete. Besides, the document gives the reason for this transcription on perennial media of the extract concerned. The reason invoked is the conservation of the memory for the future, for the following celebration in about 110 years. It's the principle of secular games. The records of the Arval brothers give since about the years 2127 AD a more or less complete transcription of the activities of the Brotherhood. But before these years, from 3230 BC, when they were created, the Arvals only transcribed relatively short summaries. On the other hand, other rubrics describing rituals that have probably been celebrated since the creation of this cult by the Arvales were included only a century later in the epigraphical form of the report. Thus, the expiatory sacrifices for the introduction of iron tools in the grove of Dea, the goddess of honored by the Arval brothers, for the engraving of the inscriptions and their exit once the work accomplished, appear on the epigraphic reports only from the year 81 on. The reasons which determine the annual transcriptions of the commentary of the Arvals on the walls of the grove were different from those concerning the secular game, which were an exceptional celebration every 100 years. An examination of the Arval records during the first decades of the empire shows that the decisions leading to the result we know were gradually taken. The first series of transcriptions of the commentary remain in line with what was found in most of the public sanctuaries of the time, that is to say, fasti in Latin, a calendar. The festive calendar of the official year was displayed along with a list of the consuls and the praetors, the magistrate of the Roman state, who served as a chronology. As the date of sacrifice to Dea Dia was mobile, it could not appear on this festive calendar. So the Arvals decided to complete each year the calendar with an extract of their commentary, giving year after year the date of the sacrifice. The formula chosen then determined them to include in the extract of the commentary also the report on the election of new members and, of course, the name of the annual president of the college, rather than to create one or two other complementary lists. And once born, this custom developed. The transcript also reproduced decrees of the Brotherhood, the date of the public votes in January, which at the beginning of the empire was not inscribed on the official calendar either. Finally, the transcription was so complete that from the end of the Principate of Tiberius after 18 AD, there was no reason to omit the other rituals celebrated by the Arvals. From that date on, there were variations in the drafting, sometimes short, sometimes prolix, of this commentary, but the general structure of the documents remained the same until the 3rd century AD. The transcript of the commentary of Arvales nevertheless provide details about the reports themselves. And that's what is interesting for ritual. We know that the support of the annual commentarius were codices held by the president or by the commentariensis. A codex was a works tablet. These codices were obviously archived in the sanctuary of the goddess or in a room located in the enclosure of a grove, since in 134 and probably in 109 AD, the Arvals question about some business concerning their freedmen or public slaves, consulted these codices and even read them entirely on the spot. Sorry, it's not my problem, so it's a bit complicated. It's obvious that their verification were not made on the inscriptions, which could not be called codices. An inscription is not a codex, so the reference was different. These passages thus show without any ambiguity that the Arvales had in the sanctuary of Dea Dia a tabularium, a library of codices, which constituted the only possible reference of the priest. In other words, the codices of this library, in which the decisions of the previous frates, Fratres Arvales were written down, formed the commentarii of the Arvals, so to say, the books of the Arvals. The inscriptions which have survived probably do not give an exact representation of these documents, since they were each year prepared for their publication, whereas the wax tablets then assembled in codices were written day by day and in cursive form. But we can assume that the commentarii are closely related to the text of the codices. The difference also is that the text of the codex did give the proof that the priest had been present in the sanctuary and had celebrated the sacrifices. He sat down, and I quote some part of this text, he sat down on the benches and he had written in the codex that he had been present and had offered the sacrifice. Yes, it's the end of the text on the screen. I guess that at every gathering, the master and also the other priest who did the same thing as the master impressed their seals under the text of the tablet. In another context, the Roman Senate voted a decision that the reports of the secular games should be engraved on a marble and a bronze pillar in order to preserve the memory of it. In the same way, as Dionysius of Halicarnassus tells in a very older period, the decrees of the Council of the Latin League were engraved on a bronze pillar erected in the sanctuary of Diana on the Aventine. It should be added that the Arval records also show that the colleges used prayer books and perhaps a booklet with membership list or a formula for the election of the annual president of the Brotherhood. But it's not appropriate to equate these booklets with the ritual text of the old theories of the 19th century. These prayer texts are in fact instruments of worship, allowing the recitation without error of the prayer or election formulas. There is no reason to consider that only the Arval brothers had commentary, and of course prayer books. The Queen de Camviri, as we have seen, also possessed them, which proved that it was not an exceptional practice linked to the Augustan restoration of a relatively obscure priesthood, but of a traditional procedure of all sacerdotal collegia. This deduction is confirmed by the existence of a Commentariensis Septem Virorum, a secretary of the Septem Viri Epulonum, the seven men of the sacred banquets, another college. Despite the differences in the functions of the two collegia concerned, the content of the commentarii of the Arvals and the Queen de Camviri is similar. Under a title including the consular dates and the indication of the annual presidencies are either descriptions of the rituals performed, attesting to the execution of the duties prescribed by custom, or the sententiae, to use the term the commentariensis used, the decision voted by the priest on all matters falling within their jurisdictions, or finally documents communicated to the college. Thus, the beginning of the commentarii of the secular games is formed by a succession of senatus consulta relating to the organization of the festival. The inscriptions of the Arval record at least one decree of the Pontifical College, as well as a communication of the Praefectus Annonae, the prefect of supplies, attributing to the Arval places in the Colosseum. But if one examines the no excerpts of the other so-called priestly books, one realizes that they could all find place in the commentarii of the Arvals or the Queen de Camviri. Most may come from a decree or an answer of the priest to an issue that had come up. Some formulas may have been borrowed from prior texts recorded in religious service records or copied into prior booklets. Most of the fragments, these fragments, were later extracted from their context by the Roman antiquaries, who quoted only the rule or expression that interested them, ignoring the proper elements of the priestly decree. One can, of course, imagine that antiquaries exploited decrees that enacted sets of religious rules, in short, great rituals. But nothing proves it. And above all, nothing allows to establish that this kind of text would be older than the other documents. Religious regulation that would contain all the prescriptions for the cult of a god or goddess are very rare, if not non-existent in Rome. So the body of writing, which is sometimes called archives of the priests, consisted essentially of annual reports recording all the decisions taken by the college concerned in the context of their regular duties or answers given in response to a public or private interrogation, as well as reports on the rituals celebrated during the past year. Moreover, in the hand of the priests, but also in the hands of magistrates, there were prayer books or some books containing oracles. We are therefore far from the pontifical or augural Bibles imagined by the historians of the 19th century. It emerged, however, from our limited survey of public priestly colleges that religious practice produced a very large number of administrative documents archived by the priest and in some cases also by the magistrate or the senate. Very few are preserved, either more or less directly by copies on stone, and or indirectly by the extracts made by Roman scholars. The disappearance of these archives, and it's the same problem in Greece, the disappearance of these archives, and moreover, even that of most of the essays that the Roman antiquaries had consecrated to them, represent an incommensurable loss. To illustrate the importance of the vanished treasure, not only for the knowledge of the public religious life, but for the whole Roman history, it's enough to take again the example of the commentarii of the Arvals. Judging by the annual volume of these comments, the magnitude of the commentarii of the four major priestly colleges, which had a lot more duties to fulfill than the Arvals, is enough to make you dream or despair. And it's often despair. For example, without the discovery between 1865 and 1869 of nine reports of the Arvales, the Mommsenian theory on the Roman imperial regime would have been different. And without the commentary of the Arvals as a whole, yes, it's almost finished, the knowledge of the political life under the empire would often be thin, superficial, and strongly marked by the topoi of ancient historiography. And without the reports on the rituals of the Arvals, we would not know a lot about Roman sacrifice. The loss is no less irreparable for the knowledge of the Roman religion. In fact, in this religion, without a founding book, this vast ensemble of commentary and descriptions of ritual represented with the priestly jurisdiction the religious tradition. Religion was oral tradition, plus the annual commentary of priests. Or rather, the religious tradition existed and was transmitted only through the annual archiving of practice and jurisdiction. In conclusion, the kinds of evidence inherited from both cultures in terms of rituals are not superimposable, as you probably realize from the comparison between Greek ritual prescriptions and Roman commentarii. Moreover, we cannot equate the political background of Rome, notably the importance of the urbs, the city par excellence, with the political background of Greece, where 1,000 independent city-states in the Aegean basin regulated their own religious life during centuries. Beyond these differences, we are unable to identify on both sides some sort of normative ritual books for a cult, a temple, or even less conceivable for the whole system. There were archives on both sides, entirely lost to us, but partially recorded on stelae, publicly displayed for the greatest benefit of modern scholars. Such records mainly attest the great flexibility of rituals in various places and circumstances, like a language able to express in various forms a message to the gods. There was something typically Roman or typically Greek in rituals performed in both cultures, but in such a common framework, a large range of possibilities was designed from place to place, from time to time. This is one of the main characteristics of ancient polytheism. I thank you for your attention. Thank you.